Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 48 of Nerd Pride Radio. 48 was the jersey number, now retired, of Nebraska native and former male model U.S. President Gerald Ford back when he played football at the University of Michigan. I did something sports related. How about that? So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on. Ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a science... you know what? I need to change that, because I don't play D&D anymore, do I? I mean, I am a D&D nerd, but that's not the point. I play Pathfinder. Yeah, you know what? We'll leave it for now. It's got a rhythm. D&D nerd, history nerd, sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, plus there's probably like seven other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my brain anymore. Oh, our sponsor this week is Gas Can Squirrel Dark Lager, available online at estoymerchandise.com. All right, before we get to the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast, updates! Update! I can't do it. Something's wrong with my voice today. Anyway, updates. Baby Metal. Last week, I mentioned Baby Metal, a J-pop band that fuses traditional J-pop sound with death metal music. And as it turns out, first off, correction, apparently what I'm calling J-pop is called idol music, and they have a whole idol music industry over there. And while I still maintain that that there was something really fascinating about listening to the Baby Metal, the one song Gimme Chocolate that I played and I recommended to you guys, someone else pointed out that the whole thing felt creepy to them because they showed pictures of them out of costume, and whereas I had assumed that these were, you know, 18, 19 year old girls, they're clearly very young. And so someone said that was kind of creepy and implied that there was something sexual about it and weird. And so did some research, and then Zen from the forums filled us in on a lot more about the industry. He is very knowledgeable. Thank you, Zen. And it turns out that, the girls in Baby Metal didn't even know what metal music was until they were actually already signed on to the group. And they actually were originally part of a different idol music group in Japan, and they were going to be forced out because they had gotten too old at age 13. They were too old for the group that they were in previously, and so therefore they transitioned into Baby Metal or maintained Baby Metal as a separate group. Anyway, moved on. But it highlights a whole lot of really disturbing aspects of the teen music industry in Japan and their culture. And there's a lot more to it, but I don't know enough details. I've read like three or four articles. I've listened to what Zen said about it. And it is just, it's an interesting situation. I mean, you know, our music scene here in America is really messed up in the way we treat stars and the way we credit things and the way we sexualize, especially young girls. And the Japanese music industry is apparently just as messed up, but in a completely different way. So, interesting and strange. So I'm just passing that along as a caveat to my last week's recommendation. But that's no fun to talk about. Let's move right on to the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. What is wrong with me today? You know what? I should have actually read my script once before I actually opened up this week, but I didn't. I'd been jotting down notes all week, and I completely forgot. I did the whole Gerald Ford thing up at the top. I forgot all of this, so I haven't done a review. Just forgive me. Let me back up to the beginning of this one. This is time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, and then the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So, what's first on the master list?
I've got blinded me with science.
That's right. It's my gaming science table corner. Yeah, something. It turns out I am talking about the statistics of simulated dice. Yeah, statistics of simulated dice. The exact spot where science totally intersects with my gaming. I love dice. I love dice statistics. And so there's some science behind it this week. So I was trying to decide if I wanted to do a science corner, if I wanted to do a gaming table. I figured, you know what? This is both. They can both get credit for it. Because they do keep score backstage, and therefore, you know what? They each get a half a point on this one. Anyway, the reason it comes up is this week, I'm reading the news over at Roll20, Roll20 being the online gaming platform that we use to play Pathfinder, currently for two campaigns that I'm in. And, later, actually, ooh, man. Looking forward to it. Hoping to do some zombie cinema maybe in about a month or two. I think that would be really super cool. But anyway, I'm reading the news over at Roll20, and they make the announcement, among other things. They're adding character sheets. They're doing whatever. But they say that they are going to great lengths to ensure that random numbers, and I'm putting that in quotes, random numbers on their dice within their games are as truly random as possible. And they do some sort of brag about how the new dice system that they implement will involve lasers and atmospheric pressure. And okay, so I see where they're going with this. There's a difference, for those of you who don't know, between when you're trying to generate random numbers on a computer. There are pseudo-random number generators, which generate numbers that, for all intents and purposes, for your use, are as good as random numbers. And then there are true random numbers, which usually involve, whatever iterative process you put your numbers through to, you generate a set of numbers, you take out like the middle four digits, and then you plug them back into the equation, and then you take out the middle four digits. You do this a few times, and you wind up getting some numbers that are fairly random, depending on what your original seed number was. And in a truly random number generator, and again, it's true random numbers in quotes, you take some number that is in itself probably random, or as random as you're going to get. So, for example, atmospheric refraction or whatever, some measure that's taken this instant in whatever state, whatever conditions. And so you're measuring something about the atmosphere. You're measuring something about it, and the measurement that you get is going to be, the exact details of it are going to be fairly random. And so therefore you take that random measurement, plug it into your whatever. You get what I'm talking about. So what they're saying is that Roll20 is planning on going to a true random number generator where they are going to actually take measurements of whatever, plug it in, and give you random numbers based on that. Which is, I mean, for me, if I need random numbers, dice, I love dice. Dice would be absolute best. And R2 agrees. But if not dice, then usually I just use Excel. I use the rand function in Excel to generate random numbers, which as I do my research this week, and Excel is only obviously a pseudo random number generator because if I'm not online, it wouldn't have any way to measure anything. So it is a pseudo random number generator. And I don't know where pseudo random numbers get their original seeds. I don't know how they go about their calculations, but I do know that there are many, many ways they could go about it. And the quality of them is variable. So for example, I've skipped ahead of my notes here. And so I'm trying to organize my thoughts. Give me a second. Okay. So anyway, the difference between pseudo-random numbers and how they're calculating all this isn't really relevant. The whole point is Roll20 is saying that they're going to upgrade to a new true random number system. And this is commendable, I suppose. I mean, it's certainly good PR for them. They're feeding the geek, as it were, because everybody wants to know that their dice are as quality as possible, I suppose, as truly random as possible. But, I mean, 2 points on that. One, even a mediocre pseudo-random number generator is more than good enough for the frickin' die 20 rolls. I mean, seriously. Yeah, like I say, I always use the rand function in Excel when I need random numbers. And I went out and I checked to see how good Excel's random number generator is. Pseudo-random number generator. Should be precise about it. And it turns out that Excel fails at the randomness tests, but only in cases where you need more than like a million generated random numbers. So for any lesser cases, indistinguishable from true randomness. So, yeah, maybe not good enough for running a Monte Carlo experiment, but way more than good enough for the ogre's saving roll against your power word blind or whatever it is you're throwing at it, okay? I mean, honestly, you're just generating a number from 1 to 20. Honestly, it's really just fine. Oh, and a Monte Carlo experiment, by the way, is some experiment where this was research I did, and since I gained the knowledge, I have to pass it along because it interested me. In a Monte Carlo experiment, basically, you just take whatever it is that you're testing or measuring, you do a simulation of it, and then you take a random starting position. So you need a random number to plug in for your starting position, and then you run all the way through the trial, you measure the results. You do this a million times or 5 million times or however many times you're going to do it, just generate a new random number and then see how it comes out, and then you can plot the statistics from all these starting conditions, what turns out to happen. That's a Monte Carlo experiment. But that was point one. Point two, and I want to be really clear on this. Normal human beings wouldn't recognize a true random number if it bit them on the ass. All right. Or for that matter, if it impaled them on a +4 pencil, a +4 pencil of stabbity goodness was the one we used. People don't know random from random. They really don't. I read an article like 20 years ago, by Stephen Jay Gould, I think. And he talked about, an image that was generated to simulate a random distribution of stars. And they went with their best random number generator. And so they literally, you know, they had a black field and they threw out stars in random positions on this field and then showed it to people and asked them if it was random. And it turns out people didn't think so because we're human beings. We're human beings and our minds are evolved, designed to find patterns and stuff. And so they're looking at what is literally a random grouping of dots, just dots placed randomly on any spot out there. And they're finding patterns in it, saying, well, see how they cluster up here and it forms a line over there. And it's the same way we find constellations, the same way we find, you know, faces on the moon and dragons in the clouds and whatever else. It's what we do. And so in order to make it appear random, what they did was they threw their dots out randomly, but set some rules on it that no one dot can be too close to any other dot and whatever. So even though normally randomly you would get groupings of stuff, that's what happens with randomness, is sometimes you get big empty space, sometimes you get groupings, sometimes you get a fairly even distribution. You never know. But to make it look random to the human mind, they had to space them out a little bit. You can't have too much clumping or it just doesn't look random, which is, by the way, why Apple had to change its whole random function on its iPods and stuff, is because if you just do truly random, you know, you hit it and you set it for random, well then, you know, every once in a long, long while, it's going to play the same song twice in a row. That stuff just happens. Or, for that matter, even if you set it so that, okay, it randomly picks a new song, but not the same one that it just played, well then you're going to occasionally wind up with the same artist. You know, songs from the same artist can come up 2-3 times in a row. Or, you get a random song now, and then it plays it again 5-6 songs from now. And people are so annoyed by that. Go online and look at is my iPod random? All right. Is my shuffle function random? And see what people say. And some people are kind of smart about it, or some people have a little bit of science about it, but they're completely misapplying it. But in general, everyone is convinced that the iPod is not random, that somehow it plays favorites or somehow it does who knows what. And so therefore, Apple changed up the shuffle function a while back so that now when you hit shuffle, it takes whatever playlist you're shuffling, it takes the entire playlist and determines a random order from it. And so it plays all of them, you know, 1 through 300 or however many songs you've got in that playlist. And it plays every song one time just in a random order. That way, you don't get a repeated song until you've listened to the whole playlist through and then you start over. So my whole point is, people don't know randomness. Now. Oh, that's right. I remember now. I don't think I've ever done segues on this show. Roku! It's time for Roku. Roku is the box that I use to do my Netflix streaming and my Amazon Prime streaming and my, what else do I have on there? I don't have my Hulu Plus yet. Still looking at getting that. Haven't gotten to it. But anyway, I watch a lot of streaming stuff on my Roku and I love it. And, what I watched recently on Roku is an Australian movie called The Castle. Have you seen this one yet? Because if you have, you're the only person I know who has. I heard Will Anderson on his podcast, Australian comedian. Will Anderson recommended the movie. He says he watches it at least once a year or so. And to him, it is the perfect Australian comedy. He says, you want a perfect example of Aussie humor. This is it. And so the minute he said that on his podcast, I came home, I checked Netflix. Sure enough, there's The Castle available for streaming. I watched it that night, and I am so glad I did. This movie was made in 1997, I think, and even at that, it holds up really well. And it stars, it's a movie about a family, an Australian family, who is just not the swiftest. They are clearly lower class, not bright, but happy in their own way. I mean, they got, you know, a son in prison and they've got, a daughter who, anyway, the whole thing, they're clearly a little screwed up, but happy family. And then, it turns out the airport wants to take their house away to build a new runway or parking lot or whatever it is. And so thus their castle is being taken from them and they need to find some way to fight this and solve it. And I'm just telling you, everyone in this picture is just pitch perfect. They play everything so completely, perfectly deadpan. The comedy is so dry. It is really, really funny. And, the guy to watch in this movie, is not Eric Bana, although Eric Bana is in this movie as the stupid brother-in-law. Did you know that Eric Bana, before he came to America to become a big serious star, he was a stand-up comedian in Australia. Really? Yeah, stand-up comedian, did comedy television, comedy movies, and then decided it was time for a change in career, so he comes to America and pretends he was never a comedian. So, yeah, I mean, good on him. It worked for him. But anyway, he's in this movie, bit part, not a huge deal. No, the guy to watch is Michael Caton. Michael Caton plays the dad in this movie, and he was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Everything about this guy's performance was just great. And so, like I say, this is it's a movie about a bunch of idiots, and you're laughing at them because they're idiots. And yet, by the end of the movie, if you're not rooting for them, if you're not on their side completely, totally, 100% by the end of this movie, you are rooting for them. You are happy for them. You love these people by the end of this movie. And if that doesn't happen to you, it's because you have no soul. All right. There's a lot. I say that a lot, but in this case, I really mean it. It's a good movie. It's an hour and a half of your time. When you want something a little bit fun, go check out The Castle, on Netflix Instant Watch. And it is wonderful, wonderful and funny. I am so glad I did it. I passed that along to you. And then, oh no! Get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went, "Rrr!"
That's right, it's time for some nerd rage. My nerd rage, I'm revisiting an old one, and some of you have heard me go on about this many, many times. I don't care, you're going to listen again. It's about money again, and you know what? This tears it. This absolutely tears it. Did you know, because you've heard me say many times that I want to change how U.S. currency is printed and minted, that I want to change the coins, I want to change the bills, I want to the whole business. Great. You understand that. It turns out, I've been saying for ages, get rid of the pennies, get rid of nickels. They are worthless. We don't need them. There's no point in having them around. Everything to the nearest tenth of a dollar. Dime is our lowest form of currency. That works perfectly. Turns out, we've known for a long time pennies and nickels cost more than their face value to make. All right, the U.S. has been losing money on pennies and nickels for a decade. All right, that's not the surprise. But did you know that in 2013, they actually cost twice their face value to produce? All right, the U.S. lost over $100 million just making pennies and nickels last year. All right, now, the part of this is that the cost of the coin is more than just the raw materials. I mean, there's machinery, there's labor, there's energy, there's distribution, there's everything else that goes into making a coin and getting it out in circulation. But it has now gotten to the point where the price of the raw materials for the pennies and nickels are actually worth more than the coin itself. All right? You follow that? The raw materials are worth more than the coin. Thus, it's actually a money-making proposition for you to go out and get yourself a bunch of pennies and nickels from the bank and then take them home and melt them down and sell the raw materials to a recycler because you will make a profit that way. That's just ridiculous, which you can't actually do that. Well, you could, obviously, but it's illegal because someone realized that, oh, God, people could be buying up coins and then melting them down and making money off of us that way. So they made it illegal to do that. And limited the amount of coins that you're allowed to carry with you when you go in and out of the country, blah, blah, blah. And Obama, in 2010 and in 2013, Obama actually pushed legislation to try and redesign the penny and nickel so that they just redesign the materials that are used to make them so that they would actually require less in materials than their face value, so that it wouldn't be worthwhile to go melt them down. And somehow, twice, that gets shot down. Why? I don't know. There's apparently various business lobbies that will be negatively impacted by that. And I don't know if it's just, you know, the zinc and copper producers that I don't know if they don't, you know, because what do you go to next? Is there lighter metals? Do you switch them over to plastic like the Japanese yen coin? Do you, you know, what do you do with it? So, you know, maybe it's the metal producers that were a problem, or maybe it's all the vending machine companies because this would alter the weights of coins. But honest to God, I mean, we're just altering the weight of the nickel. It's not like pennies are accepted in any vending machine worth its salt anyway. I don't get what happened. But for whatever reason, big business comes down on money reform. And we're not even talking about getting rid of pennies and nickels. We're just talking about making them affordable to produce. No, we're not even allowed to do that. So, although, okay, well, I'm going to take a little interlude from my rage here for just a second. One guy with a brain who's been in Congress is Jim Colby. He's a Republican. 11 terms as a U.S. representative from Arizona, repeatedly pushed legislation to ditch pennies excuse me. I'm sorry. I thought I was going to – yeah, I should have a cough button. That's what I should have. Anyway, repeatedly pushed legislation to ditch pennies once for all. Jim Colby also came out as gay while he was in his 50s as a Republican, an openly gay Republican, won re-election in Arizona 5 more times after that. You want to know why he finally left office? Okay. This is actually, I guess it's not really a rage interlude. It's going to be more of a mini rage within the rage.
Nerd rage.
Do you remember the Mark Foley sex scandal last decade? Because Foley was sending sexual emails and instant messages, stuff like that, to teenage pages working for him in Congress. All right, male teenage pages working for him in Congress. And not that the gender should matter, but it did at the time of the scandal. Jim Colby knew about that in 2000, knew what Mark Foley was up to in the year 2000, and reported him immediately. All right, took it to the whoever was in charge of the page program, made all the proper reports. And he assumed the whole thing was taken care of, that he'd been disciplined in some way, that we put a stop to it basically, until, of course, the scandal broke 6 years later. All right. And so 6 years later, oh, now it's all out in the media that Mark Foley's been, oh, he's been doing inappropriate things with pages. Oh, this is horrible. And so when the scandal breaks, the Republican leadership tries to claim that, well, they had just been made aware of this situation. They had no idea anything was going on, even though Colby had told them 6 years before, and now they're trying to pretend that they didn't know anything about it. So Colby points out that he actually had reported all of this, and once he gets his nose back into it, oh, now he finds himself under investigation, that suddenly people are leveling charges at him that he had inappropriate contact with, because, you know, he is gay after all. And so They made all sorts of allegations of his inappropriate behavior, whatever. So millions of dollars in legal fees later, Colby was completely cleared. He was completely innocent on all charges. He had never done anything inappropriate. It was all just dirt being stirred up to detract from the scandal that was going on, et cetera, et cetera. But after all of that, yeah, no way was he going to get reelected after all that crap. So 2007 was the end of his legislative career. Although in 2010, I move on and find out that, okay, Obama appoints him to the Advisory Committee of Trade and something or other. So he's back working with money because this is his passion. And it turns out that he's also, this was the last thing in his bio that I noted, that he was he's currently the co-chair of the Dollar Coin Alliance. The what? Oh man. All right. I'm on this one. So I go look up the Dollar Coin Alliance and yeah. This is exactly what I've been saying forever. Here's Jim Colby at the forefront of it, saying that that we need to stop printing dollar bills. Well, duh, of course we need to stop printing dollar bills. We need to switch it all over to dollar coins and just be done with it. And the reasons are many. Go over to dollarcoinalliance.com or whatever their website is and read up. They've got a whole report. They've done all the science and research for me. It's green. It saves money. It makes us more efficient. There's all sorts of things that it does. Because in my personal opinion, I mean, combining the idea of, all right, you get rid of the dollar coin or the dollar bills and only use coins. As far as I'm concerned, here should be all of U.S. currency. Ready? Here's the list. We need dimes. Then we need, hold on. I have to answer this. Sorry about that. That's my work phone. I really need to change the ringer on that thing. All right. Here we go. I was saying that here's all the currency that the U.S. needs to have right now. Ready? You start off, the smallest coin is the dime, and then the next coin would be a 20-cent coin, because, hey, without nickels, we're rounding the nearest tenth. You can't have quarters. So a 10-cent coin, a 20-cent coin, a half dollar, and a $1 coin. And then if you want to get all fancy, the Canadians have had really good luck with the $2 coin, and I personally think we'd be in good stead to do that as well, but that's kind of optional. So 10-cent, 20-cent, 50-cent, and dollar. All right, and then your bills, 5, 10, 20, maybe 100? I don't know. Really, hundreds. Really, the main use for hundreds is large anonymous drug deal type transactions and other illegal operations. I mean, that's your main reason for large numbers of $100 bills. I mean, not that hundreds don't have their uses in other places, but there have been other people that have been proposing getting rid of the hundreds just to cut out on that avenue for untraceable crime payment. You know, force them all to turn to Bitcoin, maybe, right? So anyway, that's what I need to change. Again, the whole idea that we still make pennies and nickels and that we're creating them at a huge loss is just ridiculous. Why will no one listen to me? I don't get it. Oh.
Fingertips, fingertips, fingertips.
Ooh, fingertips. Just going to clear some minor stuff off my master list, stuff that doesn't warrant a full segment, but we'll cover it here. The first one on my list, and I wrote down sledding and climate change. I hope this doesn't get too political. Here's the thing. When I was a kid, we used to go sledding every year. All right. And in fact, when we went sledding, I mean, we went sledding often enough that when I was a kid, every kid in my neighborhood owned at least one sled, probably multiple. Lots of them were the old metal run, the wooden sleds with the metal runners on them. And, half the kids I know actually got run over by the metal runners at some point. I ran over my brother at least once. You're welcome. He had to go in and get stitches for that. Our family also owned a toboggan, which for kids was hugely dangerous because I'm guessing there's some sort of steering mechanism because there's the ropes there and you can – but as kids, no, toboggan is just a straight line of death that you hop on and it goes straight down the hill until you either hit bottom or a tree. And in fact, God, I remember one year. We went out to, we usually went to, was it Wolf Hill? And it was just a place, it was right in the center of town. But Wolf Hill, they actually set up where you could go sledding. It wasn't a huge hill, but it was fun. And it was a big, long, wide thing. So, you know, dozens of families could show up and everyone would have room to go sledding down this thing and drag your sleds back up to the top. And it was cool. But then once we went to Bear Hill, I think that was the one. And we had to go out back in the woods for this one. And I'm imagining, now, as an adult, I'm looking back on it thinking that, you know, it wasn't much larger than the hill we were used to, but it did have trees on either side, and it was rather narrow. And like I say, I'm sure knowing that our parents took us there, we went there with like two or three other families, and knowing that our parents took us there and let us go sledding down it, it can't be as huge and dangerous as I was thinking. But to my 8-year-old mind, the way I remember Bear Hill in my mind was that the thing was probably, 3/4 of a mile long, went down at over a 45-degree angle, and was as narrow as a footpath. Like, literally, as you're cruising down the middle, you would have trees flying past almost within arm's reach on both sides of your sled. That's how I picture it in my head, okay? That I'm essentially going down a narrow video game tunnel where I have to thread the needle or die. That's what I remember in my head. I'm sure it was much wider than that. I'm sure it was nowhere near 3/4 of a mile long, and certainly not as steep as 45 degrees, but I cannot get that image out of my head. It's burned into my brain. And we went down that thing on the toboggan, all right? The toboggan, like I say, the thing is several feet long, like long enough that we were fitting. The toboggan, it's one of those Calvin Hobbs sleds, for those of you who are old enough to remember Calvin Hobbs. That's what Calvin and Hobbs were riding down the hill half the time, was a big long toboggan. And so we had like 4 or 5 of us kids, all, ranging in age from 5 to 10. We're all packed on this toboggan, and then boom, they push us and we go straight down this hill. And again, in my mind, we were just inches from death the entire way down. It was thrilling and frightening and amazing. And so this year we went snow sledding this year, up at Great Bear in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And the only reason we got to go sledding this year is because Great Bear up in Sioux Falls makes its own snow and keeps a hill ready with snow whenever the days are appropriate for it. And so we went up there and we went sledding for a whole morning. We spent a few hours there and we got all cold and wet and had a great time. It was really cool because you go sledding down the hill and then you go, drag your inner tube over to the side and they hook you this little chain pulley thing and they drag you back up the hill. You don't even have to climb the hill on your own and boom, you slide back down. I had a great time. And, as we're up there, we're all talking about it. And dude, I don't know about any of you. I have always grown up, further north. I've grown up in places where we have real winter. All right. Born in Texas, but grew up in Nebraska and New York mostly. And so between Nebraska and New York, from the time I was little, I remember every single winter, you would get some initial snowfall, maybe in October, early November, and then it would melt. And then somewhere mid, late November, you'd get a real snowfall. And then you would have snow on the ground nonstop from November until February. All right. And sometime in February, maybe sometimes as late as March, finally the snow would melt off. And then, going into March, maybe April, you'd have, your last snowstorm, maybe even as late as May on a really good year. But most of the time, end of March is when you'd get your last good snowstorm of the year and then be done. But there was snow on the ground for at least 2 solid months, three solid months, because it would start sometime in November and it wouldn't end till February. You would always have snow on the ground through those months, usually right into March. That doesn't happen anymore. And it's not like I've moved. I'm still living in Nebraska. I'm still living in the same place. And the last 10 years, I cannot remember a single year that we had a solid snow on the ground for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. You know what I mean? Like, it is every single year. It's pretty common that you'll get snow and that snow will stick around for a little bit. But like within a week, it's almost always within a week, week and a half, you will have a warm enough day that almost all of your snow melts. And then it'll start over with the next snowfall coming up. So we can still get plenty of snow and it still sticks to the ground. But then we always have enough warm days all through the winter, all winter long, that snow will melt off. And then a new snowfall will come down and then that'll melt off. I haven't even had to get to my snowblower out this year. I've gotten sent the boys out there with shovels like 3 times and there's like scraping 1/2 inch of snow, 2 inches of snow off the walk and that's it. Nothing. Haven't even had to bother with the snowblower. So to me, I'm not going to get into a big political debate here other than to say that at least from my experience, climate change is right there. You're looking at it, and not like any of you were questioning it, but trust me, I'm surrounded by enough people who question climate change, who question the idea of whether people are, you know, humans are responsible for climate change, whether there's anything that we can do about it, whether there's, I'm right in the heart of red state Republican territory, and I have plenty of people who are willing to debate that point with you if that's the sort of thing that you enjoy doing. And I don't want to debate that point. That makes me really tired. But what I will say is, yeah, come on. Do you remember growing up here? Do you remember the years when every single year you had snow all winter? If you had a warm enough day in December or January to melt all your snow, that was a freak occurrence. That was something that everyone talked about for a long time because that would have been weird. Nowadays, that's the norm. That's just a sign of the times. It's just something little. Well, okay. I'm sorry. I meant a little point in my fingertip segment that I'm not going to spend any more time on. I didn't mean that climate change itself was a little thing. I really need to be more clear about that. What's my next fingertip? Ooh, technology. Technology. It says Kindle and the bath. My wife about 2 weeks ago she had a long crappy day. She said, all I want to do is go get myself a good book and go relax in the tub and read and feel better. And so she gets everything set up and she's drawing herself a hot bath. She gets her Kindle. She gets in, and as soon as she gets in the water, opens up the Kindle and goes, ah, crap. I'm like, what? What's the problem? She goes, I thought I bought a new book and I didn't. So I'm like, well, it's all right. I can get it for you. She says, well, I've got stuff on the wish list. I'm like, I know. So I get onto my computer in the bedroom, my laptop, and I log on to Amazon.com. I pull up her wish list of books in Amazon. I just take the first one off the list and I click one click buy. Boom. And literally 60 seconds later, she has it up on her Kindle in the bath. She never even had to get out of the bath. She's got it on her Kindle and she's reading. And to me, this happens to me frequently, probably happens to you guys too, but just that moment of amazement of, do you realize the world we're living in? Who needs jetpacks? Did you know that would you have dreamed 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Would you have dreamed that you would live in a world where a woman can be laying in a bathtub holding an electronic reader and she has nothing to read? Her husband in the next room, wirelessly, not connected to nothing, her husband in the next room opens up his computer, clicks a few buttons, and magically a book, a whole book, is transported to the device in her hands in the bath. That is amazing. It's magic is what it is. All right. So I love technology. I am constantly amazed by it. And it was just one of those that particular moment just struck me. How cool is that? And then my last fingertip item is, yeah, you know what? I was going to talk about Roll20 again, but I already did Roll20 in the gaming science table corner or whatever I called it this week. I don't think I'm going to dwell on Roll20 right this moment. Maybe I'll bring it back next week. We'll see.
Fingertips. Fingertips.
And that music leads us right into the badass movie quote of the week. This one is... Do I need to set it up? Why do I always even ask? Let's just go straight into it. There's two people in this one. Sorry, R2. There's two people in this one, Celine and Michael, and it'll open up with Celine. So, quote, "Lycans are allergic to silver. We have to get the bullets out quickly or they end up dying during questioning." Michael responds, "Well, what happens to them afterwards?" Celine says, "We put the bullets back in." End quote. And that, of course, is Kate Beckinsale and Scott Speedman in the movie Underworld. She's a vampire discussing how they treat their werewolf enemies. And while that quote is completely badass, it is also, you want to talk about the cheesiest, over-the-top dialogue. That is absolutely it. That is, I mean, that deadpan of the camera, what happens afterwards? We put the bullets back in. Oh yeah, see, that's, and you think, well, that's just bad writing. That's just over the top. That's too much. But no. This is a movie where she spins in a circle, firing two machine guns at the floor to use the machine guns to saw a hole in the floor like the coyote cutting away underneath the Roadrunner. Okay? That's what she does, and it works, and the floor drops out from under her so that she can land in a dramatic pose and start blasting crap at the bottom. All right, that's the kind of movie it is. Therefore, we put the bullets back in, is a perfectly appropriate line for that movie. Underworld, again, is another one of those that is a bad, bad movie. Everyone knows it's a bad movie. Don't care. Fun, fun, fun. Have I ever told you the first time we saw Underworld, that we saw the ad for it? My brother and I and our wives were watching 28 Days Later, which was also wonderful in the theater until it turned into Die Hard. We were watching 28 Days Later at the theater, and Underworld was one of the previews that they showed before 28 Days Later, and neither one of us had heard a single word about Underworld before we saw that trailer, and both of us were sporting wood before the thing was done, because, oh my god, vampires versus werewolves with guns in what looks like the Matrix? Oh, what's not to like? And it turned out to kind of live up to that promise and kind of not, but it's Underworld. It's fun. Having done the badass movie quote of the week, you know we only got one part of this show left. And that's the, get ready, because the voice, I don't think the voice can take it. It's the Pod-O-Matic! I made it, R2! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. The end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. Where these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums, my forums. I'll add it to the Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. I know you got a number there, but I haven't explained R2 in a while, so I know some of you already know this. But for anyone who may be new, since we just fired up the cast again, you know, 5-6 episodes ago, when I say Pod-O-Matic, this is literally a Star Wars Trouble game. You know Trouble with the little Pop-O-Matic bubble in it, and it's, you know, like basically like playing Sorry or Parcheesi or whatever, but Trouble uses the little Pop-O-Matic there in the middle of the board. And this one was a Star Wars themed one, so in addition to a six-sided die inside the bubble, there's also a little R2 figure, and then it makes those cool noises every time you pop it. And so what I've done with mine is I very carefully cracked the little bubble out of here and was able to remove that. It's got the little tabs on it. And so I pulled the bubble out and I replaced the six-sided die with two tens. So I've got two tens in there as percentile dice along with my R2. And so therefore, every week I resort my list so I have 100 fresh ones up at the top of the list, and then boom, here comes R2. And he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And the first one, now that I've rolled three times, the first one is number 15 from Billy Bob, who says, "What's your favorite modern nation?" And then in parentheses, Billy Bob adds, "other than the USA, if that was going to be your answer." My favorite modern nation would be, Canada's my go-to. I mean, but Canada, no insult to my Canadian friends, but, you know, you picture it kind of as America light, which I know really offends them, because lots of nations around the world easily confuse Canadians for Americans. Our accents are similar. We have a lot of the same cultural things going on because, I mean, they're so close to us, and we are such a huge, belligerent, dominating nation that they absorb a lot of our cultural stuff. But I like Canada, and I like making fun of Canada, but I also like Canada. I've been there a few times. It's fun. I also have a real fondness for Australians, because again, it's a nation that I could easily see going to and staying for an extended period. But it's because, you know, they're English speakers, which makes it really easy on me. And from everything I hear, Australians have a lot of very similar attitudes to Americans. I mean, they're not the same people, but they're similar enough that I think I could feel comfortable there. So Australia's cool. But for non-English speaking nations, I have always been really fond of the Netherlands. Well, actually, Ireland first. Ireland, when I was growing up, and I thought, and again, that's another English speaking nation. But when I was growing up and suspected that there's Irish heritage on my mom's side, because, you know, they've got all sorts of Irish names in their background, or possibly Welsh. but always assumed I was part Irish. There's red hair on that side of the family. There's some Irish names. We don't know our exact heritage, but we suspect Irish. So I just always thought Irish was cool when I was growing up. Better than my dad's side, which is all English and French. There's nothing fancy about English and French. But Irish, that just seemed a little exotic. But I also, like I say, I like the Dutch. I have talked about the Dutch on this podcast a couple of times. I like the Dutch for their prudence, their reasonableness, their foresight, their far-reaching vision, and their ability to take care of it. They just seem, I'm sure, you know, people who are Dutch can speak to current politics in the Netherlands, and they can talk about how messed up things are from their own perspective. But in sort of a global sense, they seem to have their stuff together in a lot of ways. All right. In much the same way Norway does. All right. And I like Norway as well. Now, Norway also has another advantage over other nations, another advantage even over other Scandinavian nations, in that Norway has a crap ton of oil money. Oh my God. They're one of the few nations that has a higher per capita purchasing power than the U.S. The U.S. is pretty darn well off. I mean, the distribution of that wealth you can argue with is unfair, or, you know, the ways that we achieve it and the kind of work hours that we do and the benefits that we receive. And you can argue that there's a lot of inequality out there. But just as a straight average, the U.S. of A has one of the highest purchasing power per person of any nation in the world. The ones that beat us out tend to be either tiny countries or Middle Eastern countries with a lot of oil, or Norway, which again, because of the oil. So Norway has their stuff together. And I also like Norway because of the whole Viking tradition that came out of Norway. I mean, we romanticize it now, but you've heard me talk on the podcast about Harald Hardrada as the Norse king who among other things was part of the Varangian Guard in Constantinople. He traveled through Russia, through most of Europe, tried to invade England, and was driven back, only to weaken England just enough that the Normans could invade in 1066. So, I'm fascinated by Norse history. I like Norway a lot. What else? Oh, and Ukraine. Again, very Eurocentric of me. So far, I've only picked majority white nations, white Western type nations. So I guess that's kind of rude of me as well. But man, I've always liked Ukraine. Always have. Just something about it has always fascinated me. And then, you know, you get things like Mila Kunis was born in Ukraine, which, you know how much I love Mila Kunis. Or Mila Jovovich for that matter. Also Ukrainian, also super hot. Again, I got a thing for Ukrainian women, apparently. And now with their recent issues with Ukraine and Crimea and Russia and the whole business, God, I feel for them. I just saw a bit. I should probably link to this on the forums, that it was Ukrainian weapons, not military weapons, but just hand weapons, homemade weapons, the stuff that protesters and rebels are using in the streets and stuff that they've made themselves. So, you know, baseball bats that have been whittled down and nails added to the end of it, or these huge handmade flails with these big duct-taped wooden handles with a chain coming off of it with some huge, you know, rectangular steel block swinging from the end of it. Various knives and various... It's just fascinating. And looking at this slideshow of these weapons, it was heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking, because every slide they got a plain background, a black background, and all you see is someone's hand coming from out of shot and holding this weapon up for display. They literally had people bringing in weapons that they wanted to have featured in this, and so all you see is someone's hand. You see their sleeve and their hand, and then the weapon that they're holding, and a lot of them have slogans inscribed on them. You know, Ukraine and freedom or peace or whatever. It's just heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking watching it go by. Weird. I really need to find that link that on the forums right now. Look for it after you listen to the podcast, but you know, I'll probably forget to do it once this is all done. Either way. So what's my favorite? modern nation that's not the U.S. I'm gonna go with the Netherlands. That's gonna be my pick if I have to pick just one. All right. Number four is Stans. In all of the science fiction, movies, books, comics, what alien do you find most intriguing? Okay, this is the companion to the one a couple weeks ago, about which alien do we find the silliest, or the most stupid, that was the question. So what alien do I find the most intriguing? I am going to have to go with the aliens from, and I think there was more than one set of aliens. It was the green, tree-like branchy aliens. But the aliens from, the book, The Boat of a Million Years by Powell Anderson. And if you've never read The Boat of a Million Years, you really should. It is a fascinating tale, about a group of immortals, people who, in the course of human history, have been born and for whatever genetic mutant freak reason, they don't die. They are immortal. I mean, they can be killed, but they don't age. They get to like 25 or so, and then they just stop aging and they live forever. And there's a whole bunch of technical stuff that goes with it. And it is their story through all of history, starting, you know, the oldest one was born about 2000 BC. The story picks up, I think, somewhere around 500 BC. And, we just get to follow the comings and goings of these various immortals, like maybe a dozen or so of them, as they just survive and get by, and how they adapt to the world over the changing centuries, and how they intersect with each other and eventually find each other. And it's fascinating. Oh, it's super fascinating. But wait, Mike, where do the aliens come in? Okay, well, here's the deal, is after all of that history stuff, we then get to a modern era where he's running them through a 1970s, I think, 1980s sort of era. And there's a bunch of political stuff, and they've got some evil bad guy politician who they have to bash on. And it's Powell Anderson making a really ham-handed political statement there in that middle section. But that is mercifully brief, because the first part is unbelievable. And then the second part, okay, a little lame. And then they decide that we move to a future where they've now figured out immortality. I'm sorry, I'm giving away the whole book here. But they, for whatever reason, they've now decided that they no longer fit in with humanity. And so the original immortals get together and they commission a ship to be built for them, a long-range spaceship, and they take off. And they head for space to go seek out new life and new civilizations, as it were. And in the course of their travels, they actually run across another advanced, intelligent race that's out there, an alien species who is doing the exact same thing we are, that they were just looking to find other people and to meet. And it's how these two cultures interact and how they research each other. And it's fascinating. And the aliens are created. I think it was one of the very first times that I ran across an intelligent alien species that A, wasn't set out to be some enemy or some stereotype or whatever, and B, was created with some thought as to what might an alien species look like that isn't, you know, it's not just humans with horseshoe crabs mounted on their heads. It's not just, you know, human beings with extra facial appliances and pointed ears. You know, not Star Trek aliens, not Star Wars aliens even. I mean, even Star Wars aliens, most of them are still just modified humanoids, just, you know, still the same basic layout, the same basic blueprint. We just change the proportions a little bit, and we change up the colors, and we add some extra appliances and prongs and horns and stuff like that. But otherwise, you know, even Hammerhead in the original Star Wars is still your basic humanoid build. Even Jar Jar Binks is still your basic humanoid. And so here in Boat of a Million Years, they were giving us an alien species where he tried to come up with it's just some possible path of evolution that didn't look anything like humans and yet still was functional and reasonable and could interact with human beings on some level. And it was fascinating. And I loved them. And I can't remember their name. I can't even remember if they had a name. They probably did. But they fascinated me. They are absolutely my favorite experience of encountering a new alien in any science fiction I've ever encountered. I said that too many times. Save me. Okay. Number 89 is from Zimney. Why does round pizza come in a square box? Oh, that one's easy, actually. It's because round boxes are a bitch to fold. Honestly, square boxes, very easy to have a flat stack of cardboard boxes that, you know, they're all unfolded, laid out flat. They stack easily, they ship easily, and then they get to the store, and you know, you just follow the pre-done bends and cuts, and you've got a box, and you're ready to go. Rectangular or square boxes are super easy to fold in that regard, whereas a round box would be much more difficult and a waste of some cardboard. Although, one of the places, maybe it's Domino's, maybe it's Pizza Hut, maybe it's there, I don't know. I haven't gotten enough takeout pizza in a while, but one of the places, maybe I'm just seeing it in their commercials, has boxes that have little diagonal cross pieces that when they fold it up, they've got these diagonal cross pieces that make it sort of an octagon in the middle. It's still a square box, but when you open the lid, there's an octagon shape formed inside of it. And I don't know how those work, but in general, no, square boxes, just because they're cheap and easy, and any minimum wage employee can fold a square box without messing it up too badly. So number 52 is from Sirius Paul. Sirius Paul asks, do you like Lucky Cats? I have 9 from Japan. Oh, good on ya. That's awesome, Paul. I don't really care for the Lucky Cats. I mean, for those of you who aren't familiar with Lucky Cats, you've seen them before. It's that stylized Japanese cat with the one paw raised, in greeting or waving or whatever it is he's doing. And Lucky Cats are specifically supposed to be good luck. And so you see them indoors of shops and homes and scattered around places. And I believe they come in different colors that may or may not have different meanings. I have no idea how a lucky cat works. But I've never been real fond of the lucky cat. To me, it brings back bad memories, and maybe someday I'll share those with you. But no, what I do have from Japan though is Tanuki. Tanuki is the name of the Japanese raccoon dog, which is a real animal, the raccoon dog. And there's a stylized Tanuki, he's dressed up in, he's got a little hat and usually a walking stick, and he's walking on his hind legs in these little Tanuki statues, these Japanese fat Tanukis. At least the ones I like are fat. You can also get tall, skinny Tanukis. You can get a bunch of varieties of them. But the main thing about Tanukis, they also bring good luck, these little statuettes. And if you're paying attention, you'll notice that the Tanuki tend to be male, although I've seen female versions of them. But the traditional ones tend to be male, and if you look, you'll realize his genitals are exposed, and his testicles touch the ground. That's the whole point of the Tanuki statue. Not the whole point, but that was one of the primary points of importance. Is that I was told when I originally got a Tanuki is that yes, the statue of Tanuki, yeah, his balls are always out, and his balls touch the ground, because if they don't touch the ground, then it's not lucky. It's the balls touching the ground that brings good luck. I have no idea why. That's just the way they're designed. That's the way the legend was imparted to me. And so I have a little Tanuki statue that is about a foot tall, fat little round thing, and he sits in my office because my wife would prefer to not have the raccoon dog's balls sitting on the ground at our house. But he is in my office, and he's rather innocuous, because even though his balls are touching the ground, unless you're actually looking and someone points it out to you, you don't realize it's his balls. You just think, oh, that's a foot that's placed in a funny spot. It's just the way his coat hangs. It's just, who knows? But that's Tanuki. So yeah, not so much Lucky Cat, but I do like Tanuki. Number 92 is Scree. Scree says, if you had a true pirate name, one that sends shivers down people's spines when they hear it, what would it be? Oh, that's easy. El Grappidoro, the stapler. Or, to be more serious, let's see. I had a pirate character in D&D once, a game that my friend Kaz was running, and my pirate was a half-orc named Masmud. Masmud Juk, which I thought was an awesome, badass pirate name at the time. may or may not send shivers down anyone's spines. I don't know for sure, but he was a cool character. Or if I had to pick, I would go Deathless, since I've got, I'm stealing here, but Boat of a Million Years, one of the characters, was a Native American who, because he was immortal, and he was ruling his tribe as sort of this god king, while he was there, and he was known as Deathless. And later he went by John, I think, but he was known as Deathless, and I always thought Deathless was just a badass name. So I would want to be a pirate, whose name is Deathless, as a surname. All right. So he would need a first name, like Jack Deathless, except not Jack, because that would be Jack Sparrow. What's another, era appropriate name that could go with it? Like Ben. Let's call him Ben. I would be the vicious and bloodthirsty pirate captain, Ben Deathless. Yeah, I could go with Ben. So Ben Deathless would be my pirate name scree. Thank you. Number 12, from all the way back to the top of the list, from Billy Bob. Billy Bob says, Miley Cyrus, revolutionary free thinker, right? Yeah, you're funny. Miley Cyrus, this all ties into the whole baby metal business that we did at the top of the show. Miley Cyrus is yet another young singing sensation who is being overly sexual for attention. It's just part of the PR. It's part of her plan. This is what her people have told her to do. It's only shocking because we want to keep talking about it. It's because people want to make a big deal about it. They calculated this very specifically to break her Hannah Montana image and make those little teen girls who grew up on Hannah Montana, now they can feel that they're being all edgy. They can continue following the same star they did before, but now they're being edgy rebels rather than being, you know, following some bubblegum pop sensation. It's all calculated. It's no different than Britney, no different than Madonna, Lady Gaga, Katy Perry pulls this garbage. Music stars have been doing this for years. Female music stars in particular have been doing this for years. It's nothing surprising. So, I'm actually even sorry I answered your question, just because, you know, the more attention you give to it, the more important you make it. And it's not really anything. It really isn't. That is 98. God, back to the bottom of the list. This is from Zimney. Zimney says, so, you know those times when you're kind of hungry, but you're also feeling kind of lazy? He says rather lazy. I'm sorry. Should be specific. You're feeling rather lazy, so you just throw together some leftovers? What's the oddest food combination you've ever done in such a situation? Oh, dude, you are asking the wrong guy. I will put together anything. I mean, anything. Yeah, I mean, your standard is, you know, and this is commonplace. You take leftover meatloaf and you just make a meatloaf sandwich. But here's the nice thing is a couple pieces of bread, or if you're feeling ambitious, a couple pieces of toast, make a great vehicle for carrying all kinds of leftovers. I mean, I've made spaghetti sandwiches before. God, there's been times when I will take anything out of the kitchen. You know, just the other night, I had some bread and some cheese and I wanted to melt them up, and as I'm just about to put my little melty cheese sandwich together, I thought, you know what this sandwich needs? It needs a little crunch. So I went and got some Doritos out, and I crunched up a bunch of Doritos and put them in between the two slices of cheese, and so it's all melty with the crunch in the middle, and that was pretty darn good. I will put together anything. God, man, I wish I'd had this question ahead of time, because I would have thought it out. But I put together lots of stuff. For example, I have got an egg cooker, and it's just a little plastic shell, and you crack one egg into it, and then if you want to throw in some bacon or some vegetables or some whatever, and you throw it into the microwave for a minute, and when it pops out, you've got a perfectly cooked egg with whatever fixings you've thrown into it. And I can't tell you how many times I will go into, you know, we had taco salad one night, And so we've got some leftover taco meat that's it's just browned hamburger with the taco seasonings in it. And so, oh man, how good was it the next day when I threw a handful of the taco meat into the egg cooker with an egg? And so I wound up with a taco omelet, melted some cheese on it, made a sandwich out of that, because again, bread is the perfect vehicle for carrying any leftovers or overs you got. That's my favorite. Oh, that one was so good. A little bit of mayonnaise on there. So, I mean, egg, cheese, mayonnaise, taco meat between two slices of toast is perfect. Oh, couldn't have asked for better. I'm sure I've got weirder examples than that even. Lots of them even. But I can't think of them off the top of my head, so. 99. Okay, good. 99 is from Billy Bob again. And Billy Bob says, I'm working on a side project. Can you send me some of your hair or saliva or skin scrapings? Maybe all three? No. Number 81. 81 is from Brasky, who says, rumor on the streets is that you used to bite your nails, but you don't anymore. What made you stop? Was it tongue fungus? No, it was not. And I can't say what made me stop. I have always wanted to stop biting my nails. I have always, since as long as I can remember, I have always bitten my fingernails and I've always picked at my toenails. So, I mean, I generally, unless I can remember when I was really little, I can remember occasionally biting my toenails just because there'd be one that I couldn't pick off of there and it was bugging me. So I'd hold on. Train. And it's going to be here a while. Ha-ha! I found the pause button. That's what I need to learn to do. See? The train comes along. I hit pause. Now I start it back up. No editing required. No extra work for me. I can get this podcast out to you even faster. Where was I? Oh, my nails. Yeah, so always bitten my fingernails. Always picked at my toenails. And it's just something that I've always done. Nervous habit. Never been able to control it. Throughout my life, there have been a few times that I have stopped biting my nails because I've always wanted to stop. I think it's disgusting that I do it. My nails look ragged and gross. It's not, and it's the kind of thing that when you do bite your nails, pick at your nails, you do it without thinking about it. And it's the kind of thing that it's disgusting to be sitting there, around anybody, whether you know them well or don't know them well, and you're sitting there going pick, 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 and you don't even realize you're doing it until that you see them look at you and you realize, oh God, sorry, I'm an idiot. So I've always wanted to give it up. And there have been a few times that I have, but it's never been for more than a month or so. Usually what happens is, you know, I'll get myself a nail set so I can start filing them and take it. God, this is never going to end. Pause button again. Oh my God, you guys, this pause button is the greatest thing ever. I mean, I've always known it was there, but I've never been able to, you know, something goes on and I just can't quite get to the button fast enough. But if I just leave my mouse on the pause button, I can get up and walk away from you guys for hours at a time. You would never know. This is wonderful. Okay. Maybe you're not as thrilled as I am, but this is great. You don't know what a pain it is to have to edit out interruptions like that. From now on, so you're going to hear every phone ring. You're going to hear every train whistle. You're going to hear, I'm not editing any of that crap out. I'm just going to learn to pause quick, and we'll be done with it. This is – all right, but we were just in the middle of – oh, it's we're still on that one? Oh, my God. It's still about my biting my nails. How long do I have to talk about this one? Anyway, like I said, I've stopped before, and I usually wind up buying, you know, a nail set, and I'll wind up filing my nails and keeping things buffed and cleaned and even and, you know, trim them up nicely. And then it'll last until about the – after the second time I have to clip them, because it's fun to clip them the first time and it's fun to clip them the second time. And then by the time it comes around to the third time to clip them, I just, you know what? I'll get to it tomorrow or I'll get to it the next day. And then I let them go just a little bit too long and one of them breaks. One of them gets peeled off or bangs into something and it gets a little chip out of it or whatever. And then once it's there and I've got that little chip, I pick at it and I pick at it and I pick at it until it's all gone again. So, I mean, really, it's literally a month at a time is the longest I've ever stopped biting my nails. And that's been, you know, maybe I've done it three or four times and then that's it. And then somehow I think it's been 2 years now almost. I don't know why I just suddenly decided, oh, I know why. I wound up getting a nail clipper that was on a key ring. And it was a really cool one. It was a little tiny round one, so it was a funny shape, and it folded up, and so it looked like just a little flat disc of a key ring. But you open it up, and boom, nail clippers. And so I had it on my key ring, which meant that I said, you know what, now that I've got this, I'm going to stop biting my nails again. Let's try it. And having that nail clipper available all the time meant that if I did bang up my nails and something chipped or peeled and had a rough edge on it, something, well, all right, just quick, get the nail clippers out, clip, clip, clip. All right, nice and even again, we're done. And it made it easier for me to stop biting them. And so I haven't bit or picked at my nails in any form for 2 years. And now it's gotten to where I actually lost that nail clipper, and I still generally have a nail clipper somewhere close, you know, in my computer bag or on the back of the bed or something. But it's gotten to where I finally went long enough, probably took 6 months, but finally went long enough that it broke the habit. Now that I get a rough edge on a nail, if it happens and I don't have a nail clipper around, I no longer feel that compulsion to have to pick at it and do something about it. It's just, I finally broke that part. And that probably, like I said, that probably took 6 months, but it worked. So there, that's what happened. And that's how I stopped biting my nails. 93. This is from my favorite person, Mr. Sirius Paul. And Sirius Paul says, what is the largest creature in D&D? And that would have to be, I'm pretty sure that's the Tarrasque. I would lay money that in standard canon Dungeons and Dragons through the various editions, I would guess that the Tarrasque is the largest. It was specifically created to be the largest creature. It was created to be the largest, toughest thing you could possibly ever run across, and it was designed as a mindless killing machine that shows up at random centuries-long intervals and start trashing the countryside for no good reason whatsoever. And it lasts for anywhere from a day to months to who knows how long, and then it disappears again. And so when the Tarrasque shows up, your god-killing adventurers have to go find it. And if I remember correctly, the thing regenerates like crazy, has all sorts of defenses, and even if you wind up taking it down to 0 hit points or negative 20 hit points or negative 50 hit points, it will still regenerate from that. And I mean, I think it was the idea that you had to get it down to negative hit points, and then while it was at negative hit points, before it could regenerate back to positive, you had to cast a wish spell and wish for it to stay dead. All right? And you couldn't like do it separately, all right? You can't make the wish early on and go, "Hey, I wish that when we finally get the Tarrasque down to 0 hit points, it's going to stay." No, you had to do it exactly in that order. You have to wear this thing down somehow, finally. And then once it's below 0, then cast your wish, and then you're rid of the thing. Otherwise, no, you just wait out its reign of destruction until it disappears again. It was one of those creatures that it's an ultimate god killer is what it is. It's when your characters are way too powerful, this is the last thing to go up against. And if you win, there's nowhere else to go. There's nothing else for your characters to do. If you beat the Tarrasque, I mean, you're killing gods. It's done. And it's one of those that was designed specifically for that purpose of smashing high-level characters. Just like the Mimic was specifically designed to get people who are looking for treasure chests. Like the Gelatinous Cube is a monster specifically designed, specifically evolved to fill up 10x10 hallways and sweep crap out of them. The Piercer was specifically designed to, all these things that are designed, the Rust Monster. Oh, that's the best one. The Rust Monster has no purpose. There's no purpose in a Rust Monster in a true ecology. And the only reason it's there is, you know, you have to imagine it was created by some mad wizard for whatever reason, and now it's there solely to plague adventurers. I mean, that's really all the Rust Monster is. That's the only opponent that it's truly effective against is people wearing metal armor and swinging metal weapons at it. All right? That's the only, it's just there to mess with your players, and that's what the Tarrasque is. But I still contend, I'm pretty sure the Tarrasque is the largest canon creature ever for Dungeons and Dragons, but I could be wrong, but I think it is. Oh. R2. There we go. 49. 49 is from Direcat. I haven't seen Direcat yet this week. Direcat says, what would you do if your entire house spontaneously turned into jello? Right this moment, I would drop into the basement and land on my son's bed. Unless the bed was also jello, in which case I would splash through that and wind up hitting the dirt floor underneath. I'm pretty sure jello cannot maintain any sort of structural integrity at this volume. And so what I would wind up with is my basement would become a swimming pool filled with jello. And as much as that seems like it might be kind of fun, I'm pretty sure would be hugely disgusting and messy and probably dangerous. I don't know if I could swim out of jello. It would seem that jello is of the consistency that I could, if I was careful about it, I could float on jello. I mean, it's got to be able to support my weight better than water, and I can float in water. But, you know, if you're at the bottom of jello, can you get back up? Or do you not float on jello because it just separates out under you and then doesn't push back the way it's supposed to? I don't know. And the worst part is that not only has the whole house turned to jello and I've lost my house, but let's assume that there are some of my possessions that don't turn to jello. Well, now they're soaked in jello. All my electronics are lost. All my paper goods are destroyed. You are a cruel master, Direcat. I can't believe you'd wish that on anybody. Number 12. We've done 12. Try again. Number 85. It's Zimny. Zimny says, clarification. They are all made out of normal gingerbread and are as strong and resilient to heat, water, etc. as normal gingerbread. They're just alive somehow. A wizard did it. That's it. I'm imagining that this is a clarification of a previous question where he asked, what would you do if you had an army made out of gingerbread? Or was he asking what would I do if I had to battle an army made out of gingerbread? Either way, it's a question I already answered, and apparently this was his clarification that went with that question, and I did not realize since they were in separate paragraphs, they just pasted into separate slots in the spreadsheet. I didn't even realize that. So, thanks for the clarification, Zim. Number 81 is also from Zimny. Okay, good. We have a makeup question for that last one, which was really my fault for being ruined. Zim says, what name would you like your loyal fans to use as a collective? And he gives suggestions. NPRians? NPRites? Nerdpridists? Something else, maybe? That's a good question. At this point, it's just friends of Mike. I mean, really, I know all you guys. Unless there's some of you out there listening who've never introduced yourself. But I just assume that of all the downloads I get, I just assume that they're all just my 12 friends. And anything above and beyond that is either duplicates or it's bots out on the web. I have no clue. I can't judge any of this. But if we had to have a collective name, Mark does this every week on WTF, Nerd Prideaholics. What are the other ones that he goes through? How about just nerd? Nerdarians? Nerdadians? Because I like Canada so much. I got nothing that sounds really good. Although, I guess we don't even have to use, you know, Nerd Pride or Nerd or NPR or any of that garbage. It could just be, you know, some clever bit that I've used in the past and, you know, and someone, or what I think is clever, you judge for yourselves. Something that I've used on the podcast, something that's regular enough that people recognize it, and they could base their name off of that to prove how clever and, you know, how inside baseball they are, that they understand the in jokes. So something like the Seven. There you go. From the, you're all looking at me funny going, the Seven? Yeah, well, because there's seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. And so you guys would be the Seven. You're all those other nerds that I wish I was nerdy as you. Right? See? Seven is not great. Haverers? Haverites? Something about havering? I don't know. I also think inventing a name for your followers is defeating the purpose. I think it is, it's something that has to come out organically. And I say that realizing full well that lots of people who have their fanatic fan followings, and fanatic fan is actually really redundant, isn't it? But they have their fanatic followers who come up with a name for themselves. I realize that in lots of instances, while those names seem to have been organic and coming just out of the woodwork, they're probably planted there by some PR person who wants to create this fervor and shape how it develops and all that. But I personally, I think it should be organic. It's something you guys as a group, if you ever feel a need to prove your fanaticism in your worship of me, and you want to come up with a name that identifies you and sets you apart from all others to show that you're better, you guys can certainly do that. But I think it would really be really pretentious of me to come up with that for you. So I'm going to have to let that one go. And no, look at the time. Hand off the buzzer there, R2. It's time for a recap.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
Thank you, GLaDOS. You sound particularly chipper today. That leads me right to my credits, and I'm stalling because I have to roll down. This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week is Weezer's In the Garage mixed with She Blinded Me by Blinded Me with Science as performed by William Shatner. Also, I did Fingertips 1 and 2 from They Might Be Giants. All these songs are available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. Enjoy them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes, write me a nice review, or check out my Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. Stop at the Facebook page. Click like. It's 9 seconds out of your day. You can do that for me. And I've been, just so you know, I've been making an effort to do that for other people. I should have done, I guess mid-credits is not really the place for a segment, but my brother is a genius, and he just talked about being nice and showing your appreciation to people who create stuff, especially create stuff online, that, you know, we go out there and it's an anonymous forest of information, and we just take what we want, and we read, and we appreciate, and most of us don't give a whole lot of feedback, and people never know who their fans are or if they're actually reaching anybody. And so make a point of going out and thanking somebody on the, and not me. Don't go out and thank me, because that would be really crappy of me to be out here fishing for you guys to give me compliments. No, go find somebody else whose stuff on the web you appreciate, whether it's a podcast or a comic or a blogger or a website or a something that you go to all the time, and the person there, the person who runs it, the person who creates it, they know nothing about you except that you are a statistic. You are a click. You are a download every week, and that's all they know. You're a click through, and that's all they see of you. Go let them know how much you appreciate their stuff. My brother started doing this, and I thought it was such a great idea. I have started doing this, and I've actually gotten some good feedback from it, and people really appreciate it. Go out and be nice to people. Actually, go to their Facebook page and click like. Go out and write them a review. Send them a personal note. Let them know, because it means something. All right? And then don't forget to check out my free games at the free games page. I have Instant Game. I have Animal Ball Melee. I have Sandbox Hill. All great games, plus 2/3 of a dozen others. All equally great. All free. All the time. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com. And I promise, if you do, I'll actually respond to you. But to be completely honest, the best way to talk to me is you come over to my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums, sign up for an account, send me a private message, post out on the forums, do whatever you got to do. We will hang out together, become best friends in the world, and we will have fun. Number 89 is a repeat. Number 70. This one's from Billy Bob. Billy Bob asks, hey, what's the lamest concert you've ever been to? Sesame Street Live. That which doesn't really, well, or Blue's Clues Live. But those don't really count because, I mean, I did those with my kids. I did that for my kids. So you can hardly count those as lame concerts because, you know what, it entertained my children and it entertained them a lot. And I'm really glad that we went to them. Those don't really count. The lamest concert I've ever been to would be Chicago. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing to say. I don't know if I should be embarrassed by that or not. But I saw Chicago when I was in high school. And I went with I was excited to see Chicago. I mean, I thought it was going to be cool. But I didn't really know much about Chicago. I had one album, and most of that album was not what they were playing, because it wasn't, at the time that I went to the concert, the one album I had wasn't their most recent album. So they were playing lots of stuff off their recent album and then lots of older hits that I'm familiar with now. And I suppose if I went to the concert now, I would actually appreciate the stuff and would enjoy it a lot more. But I didn't know any of the music I was hearing. Where we were was, it was first balcony, so it wasn't really far back. But it wasn't great. And so, it was just random pop music washing over me, and it meant nothing. I didn't get anything out of it, and I was distracted the entire time because I was there with a girl, and I didn't buy her the ticket, so it wasn't like I bought tickets to this concert for us as a date, but we both bought tickets and went together, and there were a couple other friends that went with us, and it was a girl that I wanted to date and never did, and she was never interested, and she was kind of a tease about it, and it was I shouldn't blame her. That's not fair. Either way, doesn't matter. My expectations were clearly different from hers, and so I was distracted by that, and it wound up being a miserable time. I hated seeing Chicago. It was no fun at all. I didn't know the music. I didn't want to be there. It was wrong. Although same auditorium, maybe 6 months earlier than that, I saw Huey Lewis and the News in concert. And let me tell you right now, that was a concert. Oh, my God. Say whatever you want about Huey Lewis and the News. In the 80s, all right, in 1987, when I saw them live in concert, Huey Lewis and the News was the bomb, man. We had a great time. So I've not been to many bad concerts, or any, for that matter. I mean, we went to as a gift, I took my wife to see Daughtry in concert, and I don't mind Daughtry. He's not my favorite, but yeah, I enjoyed some of it. And then there were two bands that performed with Daughtry, and Oleander was the opening act, and then Daughtry, and then was it Three Doors Down? Third Eye Blind? I think it was Third Eye Blind. I think it was the next one. And they were lame, whichever one it was. I shouldn't badmouth them until I know exactly which band it was, but whichever band it was doesn't make any difference. They were just lame. It was every single set was here's a song, and then they'd play it, and then boom, lights would go down, frump, here's another song, boom, and they never moved, they never did anything fancy, it was, didn't enjoy them at all, but the overall experience, seeing Daughtry, seeing Oleander, they were good, it wasn't bad, it wasn't my favorite, but it wasn't bad, but then, all the other concerts I go to are awesome, the best one, absolute best one would have to be Weird Al. Weird Al Yankovic puts on a show, my friend. If you ever have a chance to see Weird Al, it's worth it. It's worth whatever you pay for it, because that man entertains beginning to end. You will not regret it. It is incredible, that show. Me and my wife went with the two oldest boys several years ago. All four of us had so much fun. So much fun. It was so good. And that's one of the last really big concerts I've been to, because the concerts have gotten pricey. It's the kind of thing that if you want to go see a play, a big production, you want to go see a play, you want to go see a concert, and you're paying, $80 to $120 a ticket to go see some of these things. And I understand that that's relatively cheap compared to some areas and some concerts, but that's too much. But we have found some avenues lately where we've been seeing bands for, $20-$25 at a shot. So, I mean, coming up next week, I am going to go see Real Big Fish in concert. For $20 a head. At the end of May, I'm going to go see Lindsey Stirling, which is awesome. We're taking the boys to that one. I got another one coming up this summer. Oh, Theory of a Dead Man. We saw Theory of a Dead Man last summer at the Iowa Something County Fair, And we just thought Theory of a Dead Man was spectacular. God, it was a good show. Really entertaining guys, really charismatic, great entertainment. We had a great time. And so Theory of a Dead Man is coming to us. We don't even have to go anywhere. I mean, like literally a mile from my house, I'm going to get to watch Theory of a Dead Man perform. Again, for like $20. You can't go wrong on that. That's a good show. That's a good time. So, but the worst concert I have ever been to was Chicago. Chicago was lame, and I'm sorry I went. All the others, you know what? I'm not going to knock them. Otherwise, I've had pretty good luck with concerts.